Hi, everybody. I'm Kevin Winder, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And like always, I have a question for you. Does talking about sexuality make you uncomfortable? You know, human sexuality has tremendous power. And so often we see this power in its corrupted form, and it causes countless problems in our world. In today's podcast, we are going to explore the two biggest contaminators of our sexuality, fundamentalism and secularism. And then we're going to compare them to some very explicit sexual poetry found in the Bible. Join me now as we see beyond our sexuality and capture a glimpse of a gift that is largely left unopened. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming back to another episode of Beyond Everything Radio. I am your host. My name is Kevin Winder. I'm so glad to have you here. I like to serve the world as an online pastor, author, and uncoach. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Sunday. I'm so glad that you are joining me. Folks, if you are listening to this because you saw it as a post on Facebook or Twitter or some other way, I want to invite you to go to my website, www.kevinwinder.com, and sign up for Winder's Windshield. I'd love to have you on part of my newsletter. You'll get all the content as it comes out, fresh delivered to your door every Sunday morning, no spam whatsoever. And it'll be content that I promise you, if you can listen to it and understand it, in 6 months, you will be a different person. Go to kevinwinder.com, sign up for Winder's Windshield, and do that today. So folks, for the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at kind of between the lines of some of the wisdom literature found by King Solomon of ancient Israel, looking through the book of Ecclesiastes, just kind of pulling out some themes. I'm not doing a Bible study, as might be typically understood, but we're really kind of pulling out something that is seen, like I say, between the lines of the pages. And today we're going to continue with some of that, but we're going to look at the Song of Solomon. Now, if you're not familiar with the Song of Solomon, it is a very graphic, sexual book of poetry. It's written between King Solomon and one of his brides, and it displays a very deep and passionate love affair. And today, the title of our talk is called Sex Poet. That's right, Sex Poet. And, you know, this is kind of the challenge we've been going through, right? I don't want to get caught up in the words on the page, right? I'm not going to make this a dialogue or a didactic about the words, and I'm not going to do a exegetical teaching series here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pan out and do the wide angle here. And we're going to have, if you read this book, and hopefully this podcast will kind of whet your appetite and make you want to go back and reread this, to go listen to it. Maybe you don't remember it as I describe it. But I can tell you everything is in this book. In fact, some people didn't want it to even be published as part of the scripture. And a lot of people try and over-spiritualize it and everything else. And what we're going to do today is really get behind what is behind this graphic sexual poetry that's found in the book of Song of Solomon. Now, Solomon and his bride depict a very free but connected sexuality. That's a very vital consideration. They're free but connected. And it has not been damaged by the two powerful belief systems that damage sexuality in our present times, in our modern times. It's been around for a long time. But these two things continue to be at war with each other in terms of sexuality. And perhaps you're going to find yourself, your own narrative, your own sexuality has been written into one of these two camps. And for lack of a better reason, this is like a metaphor of driving down a road that has two very deep ditches on each side. Some people really see the problems in one side, so they swerve their car and inadvertently drive into the other side. I want to prevent that from happening, and the way that I'm going to do that is use the Song of Solomon as the center of the road, right? That's the metaphor that's going to keep us on track and help us see the problems of the framework that we're using. And the first framework that we need to look at that has really caused problems in our world with regard to our sexuality is that of fundamentalism. You see, sex remains today a cultural taboo because fundamentalism has convinced us that sexuality is either wrong, it's depraved, it's inappropriate, or at least a very deeply private matter that shouldn't be discussed, at least not openly. Now, you can pull out of any one of those perspectives, you'll see that they're founded in fundamentalism. They're founded in some moral framework, right? And human sexuality isn't really celebrated in fundamentalism. Now, I know some of you might push back and say, well, it is celebrated. No. It's only really tolerated within the narrowest of confines. And if it is celebrated, it's only celebrated behind closed doors between two people who probably have a freedom that is not expressed in the institutions of power to which they subscribe. And what I mean by that is that it's not celebrated. But that's not what we see here in this book of poetry, in the Song of Solomon's. It is robustly celebrated, right? Now, this vein of fundamentalism, it runs so deep, right, to kind of, you know, minimize sexuality, to see it as depraved, to see it as inappropriate, to see it as wrong, right? This runs so deep that even sexual attraction has become synonymous with the sin of lust. And I can't tell you how many people over the course of my work in the church, 25 plus years of working in a church, how many men have come to the door because they read a passage that dealt with lust and they felt like, man, I had sexual attraction and that was lust and now I'm just as bad as an adulterer. And I can tell you that that's a bad interpretation, right? The Greek word for lust is epithumia. And it's so often translated in the Bible as evil desire. But epithumia actually means over desire. It means it's not that the desire is wrong. It's that when you disproportionately weight that desire, that it creates serious problems. So that's a big shift, right? I mean, we're taught that, man, it's not only is sex bad, but even to want sex is wrong. And that vein of fundamentalism hurts people, right? It has lied to the world by telling us that our sexual desires are sinful and that they need to be eradicated if we would please God, right? So you have all of these kinds of vows of celibacy, of all these kinds of tools and projects. I mean, you should see the number of things in the Christian world that are designed to deal with pornography, right? It's all about trying to stop the evil sexual power from getting in, and it's always outside in. But Jesus reframed all of that in Mark 7:21 when he said that thing that's inside you trying to get out, that's the thing that corrupts you. It's not the thing coming in from the outside. So there's not a pornography or an image on the outside trying to come in and corrupt you. It's the pornography on the inside that's trying to get out that's so bad. You see, self-governing our sexuality is wise, but vilifying our sexuality actually corrupts the gift. And it is a gift. And I think we see that in the book of Song of Solomon. Now, the damage that fundamentalism does to humanity is really incalculable. You can't even possibly explain just how many relationships are fragmented, are broken, have poor communication because of misunderstandings surrounding people's sexuality. Our sexual energy and the experience of our sexuality is no more a sin than the capacity and desire for food, right? Now, I did a post on this. You can go back and check it out. It's called The Food Network and Porn. And I compare the impulse of sexuality and the impulse to eat and the difference in the way our culture spins it. This will help you see what I'm talking about when I show you the thread of fundamentalism, how it's woven through the world, where anything sexual is considered bad, but you can have the food network and just totally become a glutton, and that's considered okay, right? This this equation that says sex equals sin is highly effective from our religious institutions. It plays into the narrative that religion uses to keep people afraid, keeps you repentant, keeps you dependent on a purification system, right? Now, you know, don't skip over this, folks. I can't count how many men that I've counseled on this. It was such a big issue that I made my PhD on this subject alone. So yeah, this is something I know about, okay? People are deeply concerned about their sexual desire. And while they may have a spiritual bent to try and progress and walk with God, this confuses them tremendously. And they don't know really where to land. And the church has done a horrible job at filling in the gaps. And so sexual shame actually fills our pews. And it creates a living hell in so many marriages. So let's not minimize the damage that fundamentalism has done to sexuality. But there's another side, right? The other side of the road is another ditch that has really damaged our sexuality, and that is secularism. You see, there are so many people who won't or can't subscribe to the fear tactics of religion, the moral codes that, you know, that weigh in on a person's sexuality and weigh in appropriately, I would add. And so as a result, by dismissing all of that, secularism has allowed people to give full vent to their sexual appetite. And while they might be free from the trap of fundamentalism, they fall headlong into the trap of secularism. Now, Timothy Keller, a pastor in New York City, said once that appetites are just not good gauges. Appetites are just not good gauges. You see, our humanity is diminished if wisdom does not counterbalance all of our appetites. So, yeah, you might have a desire for a donut, and it might be so good you could eat 6 or 8 or 10 or a whole box, maybe even 2 boxes. But your appetite is not a good gauge of what you need. If you fed yourself only donuts, you would become sick. You would diminish the quality of your life, and you would diminish your very humanity. Sexuality is no different. Just like food, it has a beautiful and meaningful purpose in our life. But just because we want something, and we might be free to have it, doesn't mean that we should. And let's face it, some people have more access to sexuality than others. Might be because of the way they look, might be because of their disposition, might be their socioeconomic status. There's a lot of different things that give a person access to this. And there's a lot of things that happen internally with our own self-image, with our own feelings, with the way that we've developed, the way we see ourselves and the way we see the world, the fears that we bring. Those all come, you know, compete and create a problem for us as well. Okay? So let's not underscore the damage that secularism has done to humanity in our sexuality. It's incalculable. Our appetites grow and morph over time. Like, you might start out wanting one donut, but pretty soon you want 7. In sexuality, the result is that without wisdom, we lose our humanity as we objectify one another and erode our capacity for true intimacy and true knowing. I mean, sexuality has become a commodity today, folks, and it's really just parceled out piecemeal into a culture that seriously cannot tell the difference between a subject and an object. Think about that, right? We just give you a little piece of the sexuality. We just show you just a little bit of it and just say, hey, just have that part of the person. You don't need them for anything else. Just get the sex, right? That is a huge problem. And while free from fundamentalism, this is anything but liberation, folks. This free sex is never free. Casual sex, folks, is an out-of-tune soul. And it creates a living hell because it neglects love. It, mark my words. Now, you might think, hey, everything is going great and I like to be the player. You don't realize then that you're in a living hell, because the day you try and really connect, the day that you truly seek for love, you'll find that it eludes you. So the Song of Solomon here then represents the highest goal in human sexuality. The wisdom tradition here offers a vast freedom. I mean, it's really anything goes. Read the passages. Anything goes. So long as it falls under the law of love. And this is vital. The law of love is absolutely vital. You see, sex, apart from the wisdom and the law of love, is degrading. It's dehumanizing. It's selfish. Love, and we're talking about the eros kind of love, right? Erotic love. Apart from sexual intimacy, right? And sexual intimacy need not be intercourse. But if you have two people who are supposed to be in love, the eros kind of love, and there is no sexual intimacy of any kind, it almost begs the question as to whether that can be called eros love at all, right? Love is not surface level. Sexuality should not be surface level either. And so when we serve it up as this thing we have and we're casual about it, we lie to ourselves. We deceive ourselves. Love never holds anything back. Like, how can we give our body away and not give our love away? That is the indication of a broken soul. See, love gives itself completely away. If we have sex without love, we are just acting creaturely or biochemically, and we are not acting in our fully human capacity. See, we disrespect our bodies, we disrespect ourself, we disrespect our maker, and our culture pays the price. Right? This is a big problem. This is a really big problem. And so now we have this framework in which we have a lens to read Solomon's poem in the first place. Now, I'm not going to read it. I would like to invite you to go and read it. You read it from your framework. I'm not going to push mine on you. You see, I think when we read this kind of sex poetry, we should not blush. We should not apologize for what it is. We should not spiritualize it either by making it way more than it is. There's people out there that say, this isn't really about sex. This is about the love of God and his people. And it may be true on another level, but this is very clearly about sex and about sexual attraction, okay? And how that embeds itself within love. But you see, folks, this helps us to see that in the Greek, there's a word porneia, which means sexual sin, sexual immorality, right? This is not harmful because it reveals too much. I see this all the time, right? Oh my gosh, I saw a nipple. I saw a naked woman. I saw nudity. I saw sexuality, or I sought all that out, and that is what has defiled me. You see, it's not harmful because it's showing you too much. The TV ratings are there simply because there's a diverse audience. But they're not there for a moral compass, folks. So, you know, rated R doesn't make it bad, and PG makes it good. You see, porneia, sexual immorality, is harmful not because it reveals too much, but because it reveals too little. You see, it forsakes the whole person. It's just showing you a woman actually acting sexually. It only shows you a man who's acting in his sexual capacity. It's looking at their body. It's not taking into account all of their insecurities, their life history, their family, their friends, their brothers and sisters. It's not taking into consideration their life goals, their needs, their debt, their health, their well-being, right? If you take in the whole person, then all of a sudden, sexuality is simply a little part of that. If you carve all that out, then that's the harm that, you know, pornography does. That's the harm that sexual sin does. You see, it's not showing you too much. It's showing you way too little. And so ideal sexuality actually emerges from the bedrock of love. It has to come from love. It's a byproduct of love. Love makes each person totally free and totally empowered. You see, love expands in the presence of others. It longs for others. We see that in the writing. And it needs others to manifest itself. Love accepts us as we are, and it accepts the other as they are. Love is this third, larger thing that both parties kind of fall or merge into. It has no bottom. But it is diminished when only one person withholds. And this pulling back is the opposite direction of love. Love is dynamism. It's moving. It's self-emptying. It's a process of emptying. And so when you hold back to hold on, to preserve yourself, you actually go against love. And that's what happens in sexuality, right? Thus, sex has to be a byproduct of love, not vice versa here. Folks, order is very important. We see in our culture all too often, oh, yeah, we're having a hookup. Yeah, we're not even dating. She's just a casual girlfriend or a boyfriend, and we're just hooking up. And then maybe one day we'll fall in love after we fall in like, and maybe if we become a couple, we'll fall in love one day. But right now, it's just kind of hooking up. Folks, that is completely opposite. It's already a sign that the depth has already been lost. So these lovers in Song of Solomon showcased the best definition, I think. It elevates sex by marital commitment. It's saying, look, I don't just want your body. I want all of you. I'll take it all on. All your insecurities, all your needs, all your debt, all your wants, all your needs. I welcome it all because I want all of you. Right? That's what a marital commitment does. It proves that you want the whole person. That should be the very requirement if you're ever going to give your body away. Don't give it to somebody who doesn't want all of you. You would diminish yourself, disregard yourself and that other person. You see, this proves that you have to take the whole person's life, not just their body. These poems illuminate that graphic sexuality can be beautiful. So hold on, Mr. Fundamentalist. Graphic sexuality can be beautiful. And yes, honoring sexuality requires some discretion, but it must not be completely hidden either, or else something is lost. You see, let me ask you this. If these poems, if the Song of Solomon was a movie, would it offend you? I mean, would you watch it? Would you only watch it if it were edited for TV? Or could you watch it in its true graphic form? Would it be a sin to watch if this were a movie? Now, let me ask you this. Would you rather your kids kill one another playing Fortnite, or would you rather your kids see this love affair on TV? See how easy it is that we have traded true love for foolish piety. Folks, these poems are here to wake us up. They are here to wake us up to the power of love. And the bride offers wisdom to her young entourage, which really just says, you need to know that love like this really does exist. But don't awaken this kind of love until it pleases. In other words, let love do what love does. Don't cut off love before it gets there, and don't try and create it when it's not there yet. You see, when it grips you, don't resist it. If it's love, there's no need to play it safe. If you can't tell the difference, then stay put, stay single, stay hopeful and ever learning, right? But don't awaken love like this. It has too much power. It's like putting a beginning driver behind the wheel of a dragster. It's too much power for somebody who hasn't quite learned yet. And so when I was growing up in the church taught me about virginity. It didn't really talk about purity. The church taught me to not have sex instead of how to love. And perhaps that was your experience too. Maybe they just saw sexual sin as the worst possible thing that could ever happen. And, you know, any parent is, they're doing every single thing they can to try and make sure a teenager never has sex, right? Or not until they're married or whatever it is. But yet, when you look at the number of people who are getting married, almost every single one of them blew it. They all have had sex before they got married. Very few ever make it to the altar. And then when they do, there's often some kind of really weird, kind of jacked up communication, and the sex isn't what they ended up hoping it would be anyway. Right? The church taught me to not have sex instead of how to love. And that kind of gave me a sense of a license of to not have intercourse, to have Christian sex, so to speak. To be honest, folks, and not to overdo it here, but I didn't really know that all the outer course that I was allowed to have, so to speak, it only taught me to objectify the women that I was really supposed to learn how to love. And so even as a Christian trying to toe a very tight line of never having sex until I was married. I was having a lot of non-sex. And that, I tell you that only to share that I didn't become better. It didn't make me a moral person. I was very much an objectifier of women, and there was no real difference between what I've done and what others might have done who didn't hold this so-called moral compass. See, most people's sexual pasts are even more jacked up than mine. And so is it any wonder that our world really needs some kind of sexual healing? You folks, I believe it's possible. Sexual healing is possible. And it's not going to happen by rewinding the clock. You're not going to go back in time and undo the thing you regret. Remember that guy or that girl you slept with and it was just a mistake, right? You can't undo the repercussions of those kinds of decisions, especially if it ended in an abortion, if it ended in a pregnancy, right? If it ended in disaster. I mean, you can't undo the clock, right? And it's not about just becoming forgiven, becoming made right with God, although that is certainly possible. There's no real revirgination ceremony, although I've seen people say that. You know, I'm getting married to Jesus, I'm putting this ring on my finger, and now I'm as good as a new virgin again until the next time when I finally am married. That kind of stuff is silly and distracting, and it doesn't get us to the place where we need to go. You see, folks, we need to learn how to love. Right now, Jesus kind of showed this to the woman caught in the act of adultery. And he asked her, where are your accusers? Where are your accusers? In other words, God is not looking at you and your sexual past and saying, oh, you blew it. No, the church will do that for you. Yeah, they'll be there to judge you and condemn you. Don't worry about that. But God himself is not. His answer is, where are your accusers? So this frees you from the past. This frees you from this reality that you have to regret, right? Just look it up, chalk it up to experience that has made you more knowledgeable. It has given you some wisdom. And now you have the power to make better decisions. This is the go and sin no more part, right? Go and try this again from a different framework. That's all Jesus was saying. All the broken, the depraved and selfish and dehumanizing sex that we've done can be redeemed. And it can only be redeemed in love, learning how to love again. Now, I know that sounds maybe trite or something else, but trust me, it's not. This is really the answer. Victims of abuse do not need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I know you've suffered trauma. I understand that. But it's not an answer to just say, I'm no longer a sexual person, or I can't go there. It's too painful. All of that can be washed away through love. You see, love and trust go together. Love and trust go together. And next week, we're going to do part two of this book. And we're going to explore how we sadly confuse the order of these two things as well. So, folks, our sexuality is vital. It's powerful. It's important. It makes you a human. It's a great expression of deep, deep passion, compulsory love, right? And I hope and pray that we find a way to recapture that. Now, I get that not everybody is sexually active. You can't be. Every single person in the world has to go through some time of celibacy. Certainly when you're young, before you're old enough to understand and explain love, before you can make the kind of commitment that makes love really possible. If you can't get there, then you need to be celibate. If you have a physical or other kind of problem that creates the inability to be sexually intimate, then that's okay. You can live in a celibate way. That doesn't mean you have to neglect sexual intimacy. It can come in many, many other ways. And of course, there's always a time towards the end of our life where this will fade away. The power that drove you so strong in your 20s is not going to be as strong in your 50s and even less strong in your 70s or 80s. And that's okay too. There's other things that start to replace this. But so long as you understand that your sexuality is not incidental, it's important. So long as you understand it's not sinful, it's a gift. Then you will have the power to open it on the ground of love.